I was just correcting it for myself, but then I remembered that it was a shared document and I wasn't the owner of it. So
I was like, oh, this is just going to be posterity's sake. Let me fix this mistake.
I know. Actually, I thought we should just spend the whole episode talking about the underlying unconscious aggression you have whenever you decided to correct my typo in my shared document on symptomatic.
Hello and welcome to the Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
And I'm Jason.
And we've got two-thirds, or wait, no, I guess there's a fourth now, isn't there? An alternate fourth of the Red Library. Say hi, guys.
Yo, yo, yo.
Hi.
What up?
It's Adam and Alex. Or wait, do you guys have special names that you use, or do you go by Adam and Alex on the show? You go by Adam, I know.
Yeah, well,
yeah, I go by Alex, too. I mean, I'm the comrade commissar of degeneracy, but...
Yeah, I know, I hear you referred to that all the time. I couldn't remember whether or not you referred to as Alex also, though.
No, just
think of it. You are
comrade commissar of degeneracy has just completely replaced Alex at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Alex is gone. I am now the being made proletarian commissar of degeneracy.
Excellent.
It's kind of like once someone makes the Hajj that you include it in their formal title.
It's exactly like that. It is exactly like that.
I'm actually, I don't know what it is about the two of you in particular, but it brings out my most undisciplined inner self.
Let it out.
Yeah. Speaking of psychoanalysis and revolutionary politics, I mean, I think Alex and I are a pretty good 1-2 punch for just embodying the id, just pure rampant death drive. That's really what we're here to do. That's why it brings it out of you, Jason. You're just not registering because it's unconscious. That's what's happening. But we're activating your death drive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's something that doesn't need to be any more active than it is.
So today was the first day post-semester for me. The first day I haven't just been drowning in work. And
nice.
I did all of our readings today.
Shit. Damn.
Yeah.
Damn.
Okay. So all of the psychoanalysis stuff that I read today just went in one eye and out the other.
Just pour it in and pour it out. Mm-hmm.
Onto the page, right in one eyeball, and then just leaked out of the other one. And
well,
so
we'll
see how this goes.
I read one of them for the first time today, and I was definitely surprised at what I read. And I think, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to think about these articles. I think we'll get into it.
I think we had better get into it. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to get us started, I have a question. Why everything got to be about dicks?
Well, because that is actually, if psychoanalysis has anything to say to Marxism and revolutionary politics, it is actually on this question, if we were to believe Ian Parker, which is the questions of the unconscious and the questions of sexuality and situation, I think. So I would say it has to be about that because that's the most radical thing psychoanalysis maybe has to say, depending on what variant you want to talk about.
That was a dumb joke, but whatever.
See,
you can answer it all serious if you want.
See, everyone thinks I just do meme talk on here, but I can be serious. I'm here to be an ice cold motherfucker tonight, to be really honest about it.
That's true. You actually are in the educator's position today.
You are.
Not solely, you and Alex together. But
so we did one psychoanalysis episode with Neil, and Neil's focus was on, you know, clinical psychoanalysis and the effects on individuals primarily, but also the effects on individuals as an aggregate, which I think seems to be where he's coming from, and rather than systemically. I don't know if that's an accurate description of the approach that Neil takes, but the way that we talked about psychoanalysis was basically on a clinical level. And I think that we're not so much going to talk about that here tonight, because it left me with the question, still, after having that conversation, why? Why is it important that Marxism and psychoanalysis have some sort of dialogue with one another? Why is there such an appeal to Marxists to incorporate psychoanalysis into their theorizing? And the biggest question to me is, why are they mostly Maoists? No, not really. That's not a serious question. But anyway, like, yeah, those are the things that were left in my mind after having that conversation. I still don't understand what the tie between the two is. Like, why Lacanian Marxism? Why Freudo-Marxism? You know, what is the attraction there? What keeps drawing those two things together? And on a broad level, I think I understand, like in the sense that the Frankfurt School attempted to find reasons why alienation affects us the way it does, why workers maintain false consciousness in the face of what they thought should be consciousness changing events, stuff like that. So I understand a need for psychoanalysis to help change, to understand that sort of thing. But I'm really interested to hear you guys explain why you're so drawn to it and why you think there's such an overlap.
Okay.
Do you want to just tell everyone what articles, because I picked these in my thorough search of something that could be accessible and relatively entry level for a discussion about Marxism, revolutionary politics, and psychoanalysis, particularly the Lacanian variety. So what did I pick here? I keep forgetting the names of them, but we got Lacan, Psychoanalysis and the Left by Andrew Collier. Let me see here. We have The Four Fundamental Concepts of Slavoj Žižek's Psychoanalytic Marxism by Kirk Boyle. And then the last one, which I actually was sort of most interested in, I'm not sure which one you read, Alex, but it's Lacanian Analysis and Revolutionary Marxism by Ian Parker, which actually I think Ian Parker has been published in Lacanian Inc. quite heavily. So, yeah, so those are the things that I picked that I thought might be entry level versus us like reading a whole text or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Ian Parker one, I think, is the one that I read today. And that's it was my first time reading it. And I was like, oh, shit, like, that's not what I was expecting. But, yeah, I mean, it was in line with the other ones. I'm sure we'll talk about it.
That was sort of
how I like it.
My glorious comrade commissar of degeneracy, would you like to unleash the daggers on this question to begin?
My initial thoughts are basically that there are a lot of homologous ideas between what Marx talked about in Capital and what Freud talks about in the subject, and also Lacan by extension. And I think that maybe there's a certain way that Freud or Lacan, I guess, could be used to maybe re-engage with the ideas of Marx in a time where it might feel passé or something too. Or maybe there was a push towards making Marx interesting in new ways or something like that. I don't know really how to explain the phenomena of like why they're associated, but I think that there are like some pretty compelling arguments for why there's a big overlap between the ideas in both Marx and Freud slash Lacan. And I think that like one of these articles that we read in particular, I'm trying to remember what the author's name was real quick. Sorry. Kirk Boyle, the article by Kirk Boyle about the four fundamental concepts of Žižek's psychoanalytic Marxism just really does a good job of like sort of showing the overlap between these ideas. Right. So I guess the first one would be symptom in Lacan as it is related to Marxism. I'm like forgetting what he actually relates it to now. Symptom as it's related to commodity fetishism and the surplus value argument in Marx as it is related to like surplus enjoyment in Lacan. And then how in this article also drive is related to the class struggle and like those ideas being like sort of argued as like homologues, I think, is actually like a really productive way of talking about Marx through the lens of maybe Freud or Lacan. And yeah, I don't know. It's productive. I think it's a productive reading of like certain cultural tendencies that we're experiencing in contemporary society. So
yeah. I always think it's useful to take something really complex and hard to understand like Marx and then filter it through something easy like Lacan.
You know, we got to distill it, right?
Yep.
Actually,
more broadly approachable.
On that note, there's something that I really liked, maybe even in spite of itself or in spite of its intentions, that I screen capped from the one from the Žižek Studies website. I forget what it's called, the one that we were just talking about.
Four fundamental concepts of Žižek's Marxism.
And I posted it in the Discord, but I want to reference it here too because it sort of forms the basis of a question. He talks about he makes mention of Jameson's Marxism and Form, and he says that you know, because Marxism doesn't exclude the adherence to other kinds of philosophy, there is, and then he says, for whatever reason, there's sort of the development of several hybrid forms of philosophical Marxism. And he gives a list, and one of his positivistic Marxism, Kantian Marxism, Hegelian Marxism, Freudo-Marxism, pragmatist Marxism, existentialist, religious, structuralist, post-structuralist, and even postmodern Marxisms. And my question is, it's going to be one of those classic Trotskyist one question, one comment ways of contributing. First question is,
I love it.
Do you actually, does that track with you? And the second, you know, and the comment is, does not track with me. And I'll explain that later, but I'm just curious what, how, if that makes sense and if that helps in any way, lay out the sorts of things we should be discussing here.
Well, I'm a big fan of Zadie Jameson overall and tend to agree with him on most things. I think that most of these variants or combinations came about precisely to address limitations or gaps within the incomplete project of Marx himself. So I would say that I think there are certain ways of reading Marx that might lend themselves to these various combinations just as a starting point, a sort of a set of assumptions or theoretical biases even about how to read Marx or, you know, the Marxist canon period. And I do think there is also a way that these different variants, I think, are trying to address gaps or limitations or you know, the way that Fanon would say we need to stretch Marx to accommodate for the decolonial perspective or to address imperialism across the African continent and Southeast Asia. I think the idea is that, you know, that Marx's framework or project is very amenable to this, precisely because of its incompleteness or precisely because of its form itself. I will say, too, I mean, I've actually heard arguments that Freud's conception of the symptom in general, or like fetishism in general, is actually taken from Marx's work in Capital Volume 1. So I think there is at least some argument to be made that, you know, in a way, some of the core insights of psychoanalysis itself are not inextricable from the Marxist critique of Capital as well. So to the Trotskyist comrade over there that had one comment and one question, I'm not sure, you know, if that answers sufficiently what you were thinking, but that's where I would stand on it. And that's why I'm very open to the Marxist sort of perspective being combined in all these various ways, because I think it benefits from it and also informs those other perspectives in ways that maybe they wouldn't also be capturing if they were just existing on their own.
So that, yes, so that helps clarify what I was getting at with my convoluted comment question comment hybrid, because I agree with everything that you said, but then I did say that it doesn't track with me, and the reason why it doesn't track with me is not because anything that you said doesn't track with me, but because I guess I don't quite understand what makes these kinds of Marxism, whereas I sort of just see like Marxism as an analytical framework. And then also there are philosophical discourses in the world. So like, just like, you know, attempts at making like a Marxist biology don't make a lot of sense to me, but biology is important. And so is Marxism. Real question is do you agree that are you a Lacanian Marxist or a Freudian Marxist or a Marxist psychoanalyst, or are you a Marxist and also a Lacanian and also a psychoanalyst or whatever?
I think this brings us to the ultimate question, and maybe actually where this particular way of looking at psychoanalysis might be fairly different than the episode y'all did with Neil, or at least it's a different way to come at it. So I will say that for anyone that doesn't, you know, kind of follow us on Red Library, that I am a practicing and licensed therapist as like my day job. I am not an analyst, but I do study psychoanalysis very heavily, and it informs my work, which is sort of, I don't need to get into the details really unless y'all want, but it's kind of like an offshoot of a school of psychoanalysis. It's very informed by it. I think Ian Parker's article that we shared, that's one of our sources, kind of really gets at the heart of this, is are these actually dialectical opposites that can't necessarily be combined, but they do have things to say to each other? And then the question would be, what do they have to say to each other? I personally consider myself more of like a revolutionary communist or whatever that practices therapy versus like a Lacanian Marxist. I actually don't call myself that because I'm actually I'm very influenced by Lacan and psychoanalysis, and I have a deep reverence for Freud. I don't necessarily kind of have that as like my starting point of how I think about politics, although it informs it greatly.
Yeah, I'd also say like my relationship to these ideas is probably much more along the lines of like fascination and like interest for its like potential to like in, you know, like reframe and enhance ways of thinking about Marxism and how it could be made relevant in lots of different like areas of study today, and like how we can sort of maybe reassert the importance of what Marx has said in today's society, because I understand your question, Jason, but like at the same time, I'm also like, it seems to me like any time that there are two disparate bodies of information and like sort of approaches to studying those different bodies of information, there almost always seems to be some kind of productive outcome of like combining those mm-hmm. like different perspectives on the world and like seeing what kind of fruitful things might come out in sort of like crossing those ideas. And like, you know, of course there are instances where it doesn't make any sense and it's not like productive in any way. But like, I think that these readings tend to be like massively like interesting, and like the kind of philosophical consequences that you end up with, I think are just universally fascinating to a lot of people who are already writing in their separate, you know, domains of study. And yeah, once again, with regard to the question about like, are we like Lacanian Marxists or something? I wouldn't say that. I come to this from the perspective of studying philosophy and, you know, graduating with a degree in psychology. And like, you know, I just became fascinated with psychoanalysis. And that's what led me to like Hegel and Zizek. And I think that from there, it was just like a done deal. Like, that's just what I'm into now. So I don't know. Yeah. I wouldn't take a label, I guess.
My interest in psychoanalysis is only just barely begun, and it is because of being in contact with you guys so much. Like,
you're welcome.
I know I do find psychoanalysis as being, I've always thought psychoanalysis was interesting, but just for the reasons of understanding the human mind, not so much as it having any sort of application that might be useful in Marxism. That is relatively new to me. And you got, I mean, because, you know, we came from a tradition that thought would, if you asked anyone about, you know, the usefulness of psychoanalysis in being a Marxist, they would have said there isn't one. You know, that maybe it'll keep you from wanting to kill yourself while you're an activist, but that's about it. You know, because I think that the approach that a lot of Marxists take is very much, we talked about this with Neil. It's like that psychoanalysis is just like, it's primarily used for convincing people that it's, that all of the problems that are that you're feeling that are making you want to kill yourself are just all in your head. You shouldn't worry about it. And it's not capitalism's fault. Just here, take this medicine and, you know, write in your journal.
Right.
That makes me big mad. I just have to tell you.
Yeah. Like, I was about to, like,
I saw Alex's face too. Alex, you want to go?
Yeah. No, go for it. I mean, I'll probably follow up with things.
Well, I do think that this is something that I think needs to be rightly critiqued, and maybe even some of the most, I don't know, primary people who are associated with some attempt to combine psychoanalysis and Marxism today, which is, I think, setting up a pretty simplistic dichotomy between like whether psychoanalysis is in the business of accommodating people to the social order as it exists, like it's about adjustment, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that even Lacan himself was very critical of ego psychology in the U.S. And I think, this is one of the reasons why, again, I'm influenced by Lacan, but I am not a Lacan stan by any means. I think Lacan's interpretation of what ego psychology was and sort of his vitriol towards the way that therapy and the developments of psychoanalysis in the U.S., particularly in like the late 40s, early 50s, and like Anna Freud and in this school, I think are like horribly and egregiously simplified and just wrong. I think that in a lot of ways, what we have missed by cleaving too hard to this sort of fundamentalist Lacanian interpretation of what psychoanalysis is, which sees anything that operates on that level as just accommodating us to the social order, I think like everyone loses because all of a sudden we no longer, I think, have a complex enough way to understand the way that alienation and exploitation and us as subjects develop in the context that we're in. So I do think that, you know, this Trotskyist position or if like what y'all heard in ISO is that like, oh, they don't have anything to say to each other. Like my thing would almost be like, well, that is symptomatic of a particular divide, which is part of the problem in itself. You know, like where in that form of Marxism is there any theory of subjectivity and what it is to be a subject within capital, like receiving the sort of boot, you know, on your fucking neck of these systems. You know, one of the things that informs a lot of my approach to this topic, you know, I primarily do therapy in a nonprofit setting, an adult education setting with people who typically are suffering from horrible histories of intergenerational trauma and poverty. And one of the reasons why I am so drawn to psychoanalysis is because it actually is, I think, a very effective tool for helping me understand and work with people as a therapist in that capacity. So I think they have things to say to each other. But we never even begin to approach that topic if our understanding is coming from this, you know, fairly orthodox reductionist kind of Marxist perspective, which is that, well, anything talking about like the individual's problems or subjectivity is just, you know, either like POMO bullshit or, you know, something that's just about accommodating us to the social order. I think that that sort of simplifies Marxism and psychoanalysis to say such a thing.
Yeah, for sure. I was thinking back to a conversation I have had with people who I respect enormously, even recently. Within the context of this conversation, somebody said, oh, you know, all those like all that critical theory stuff like Deleuze and Foucault and Gramsci and Lukács. And it was just like,
what?
Right. So basically what they were doing is they were saying like, oh, all of the people that there are who have talked about alienation and subjectivity at all are a school of thought, even though some of them are Marxists and some of them are not. You know, it was an intentionally glib hand waving of, but it belies a real problem in a crisis even in Marxism that I think goes back to let's call it the first of the notes that Adam presented to us, which is the suppression of psychoanalysis and also the systemization and codification of what work of a Marxism with a capital M in the Stalin era, where there's like things that fit and things that don't. Which really, it like you said, it simplifies Marxism and whatever the other thing is to the point of being not nearly as useful. And it also it forgets or it ignores the way that Marxism is the development of a critique of political economy. So like Marx didn't invent the concept of value; he rescues it from obscurantism, but he gets it from Ricardo and Smith. He makes it, you know, by engaging with the thinkers that preceded him and the thinkers of his time, he develops based on, you know, assessment of the world as it's actually happening in his own time. So the idea that it would be fixed, that this is Marxism now, and it goes that way, and then there's these other things, other ways of engaging with the world, and they just don't ever intersect. I would agree that's bad for both Marxism and whatever other thing it is.
I just wanted to be clear that wasn't like an official position of the ISO. That's just the general attitude that I was trying to illustrate. But like as we read here in Lacan's Psychoanalysis and the Left, which actually came out in the International Socialism Journal, which was would have been the precursor to the ISO's journal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually makes a defense of psychoanalysis and also mentions that Trotsky defended psychoanalysis. Which is interesting because of how many Trotskyists I know that are just completely dismissive of it. But I think that most people that would describe themselves as some sort of Leninist or Lenin-derived subsect of Marxism are very dismissive of things that aren't directly related to the emancipation of the working class in their own minds, right? So side notes about alienation and oppression and stuff like that generally don't tend to mean much to them. Previously, I mean, now that pretty much oppression is the only thing people care about anymore. But yeah. Am I going to get canceled for saying that?
You're always already canceled. Yeah. Anytime you make content.
I wasn't being dismissive of oppression. I just meant that, like, you know, there's...
No, don't dig the hole. Don't dig it.
Yeah, it's better to just embrace the cancellation.
Oppression is good, actually.
It's coming either way. Still getting hung up on the first note of what I presume are many. there's a distinction that I think can even be made between somebody like Trotsky's defense of Freud and psychoanalysis as, you know, as a scientific discipline in an embryo. And then someone like Wilhelm Reich, who is purports to be or tries to be a psychoanalytical Marxist. And the difference between the two in their approach to both Marxism and psychoanalysis seem to be pretty significant. But I've only read one book by Wilhelm Reich, and it's called...
Is it the fascism book?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Mass Psychology of Fascism.
Mass Psychology of Fascism. And I have to admit that reading that book, I didn't feel more equipped to talk about psychoanalysis or more interested in it. It was other stuff. It was the stuff that you have recommended.
That would have turned me off, because I think that some of his ideas about fascism are absolutely fucking ridiculous. But
some of the stuff in there is actually really interesting, though. But it has to do with the basic, the political argument to be made about appealing to the mystical side of life when that's something.
That's
a little bit off the point, though. That all I meant to do by raising that as a dichotomy is what seems to me to be the difference between a Marxist who agrees with or appreciates psychoanalysis versus a Marxist who is trying to fuse the two, at least in my extremely limited conception of what that would mean.
Yeah, I was maybe going to just refer back to one of the articles. I mean, I think right up at the beginning of the Lacan psychoanalysis and the left article that we read, Collier's basically leveling a criticism against Lacan's version of psychoanalysis and kind of its relationship to science and kind of trying to discredit it as a scientific approach, which, I mean, I understand. I think maybe the point that Collier was making there. But I will say one thing. I think that there's actually like a much more of a similarity there, at least what I understood to be more of a similarity between like Lacan or Freud and what Marx does, in the sense that you can only really consider Marxism a science, so to speak, if you're a partisan, right? Like, to Marxism, like, you don't find like economists acknowledging that Marxism is a science, right? Like, and it wouldn't be generally accepted that Marxism is a science by anyone other than a Marxist. Right. And I think that, like, in the same vein, you find the same thing in psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis takes a very like specific approach to the unconscious of an analysand, like the symbolic dimensions of like their experience of their life, the things that they mention about their life. And there's like a structured approach that you have to take as an analyst. And I think that it takes on a very similar character. Like, if you are someone who is A, seeking analysis, or B, participating as an analyst in that interaction, like, you've both sort of like taken the red pill or whatever of like, this is now analysis, and this is what we have like agreed to do and acknowledge will have some effects in some way or another, right? I don't even know if it's the red or the blue pill, man. I don't remember, but like, all I'm saying
is the black pill. It's the black pill.
Like, yeah. It's the purple pill. But like, basically at that level, right, there's a degree to which, once again, you can't really call like a Lacanian approach a science unless you're acknowledging that psychoanalysis has like a certain dimension through which it's approaching problems, and that it doesn't play at objectivity. I don't think that anybody in psychoanalysis is claiming, is trying to stake a claim at objectivity, which I find interesting that somebody like Collier would write about psychoanalysis and take this position of like, well, this isn't objective. This isn't something reliable. Like, their terms aren't even well defined, and, you know, yada yada. He goes on and on, but it's interesting because I'm like, who said it was? I don't think that there's any psychoanalysts out there being like, this is the most objective way of looking at everything in the world. Like, that's not how the practice is partisan, and it's like sort of like a like only acknowledged to be partisan, only acknowledged to be effective when it is partisan, I guess you could say. So.
Mm-hmm.
with regard to science anyway, those are my comments about that. I think there's like a lot more to this article that I'm critical of, but not in the sense that I disagree with the like major point that's being made by Collier, but I do disagree with a lot of the criticisms he has of Lacan from that perspective of like trying to find some access to objectivity within psychoanalysis.
So basically, fuck science. All my homies hate science. I got you.
Well, what is science really offering us, right? I'm not saying fuck science. I like science. Please believe me. But like at the same time, what psychoanalysis is trying to do is acknowledge that substance is subject, right? And not just like this desubstantialized, like flat, affectless actuality out there that just exists, right? Like there is a dimension to which our apprehension of the material reality around us also feeds back into us in our understanding of itself. Like it's not inert. It's not just there, right? It is encompassed in like a symbolic dimension of ideas that has like a historical genealogy, and like there's a lot to it, right? And what science is offering us is like an escape from all of that, that sort of subjective content and substance. And it's just trying to give us the desubjectivized substance, right? That is flat and safe. So I think that what science offers is like extremely important, but I think that criticizing psychoanalysis from the perspective of like the objectivity of science is like, it's like just neither here nor there, right? Like psychoanalysis would be like, we're not aiming at the same things. So
sure. I mean, you could do something similar by saying, there's no such thing as culture because it's too shifting and it's fragmentary and it's contradictory and it is defined in multiple ways. And a dialect can become a language or vice versa. And so none of that's real because it's not like objectively verifiable and quantifiable in a lab setting. And like, if that's what we're talking about, then very little is important at all.
Right. That criticism is actually levied in that article. I think that he actually kind of goes along that line of thinking of like, well, at least Freud acknowledged that the circumstances that psychoanalysis was facing at the time that he was studying different people and their symptoms was like contingent, and that Freud leaves it open for contingency, that these don't necessarily have to be the enduring qualities of like what society is consisting of, and that they could change, kind of like this Platonic version. And then like that Lacan sort of like makes it concrete and like sort of forecloses the opportunity for society to be different and just like makes these into like the principles of formal psychoanalysis and like doesn't leave it open for that like shifting of cultural perspectives or like that sort of Western European values type of argument. And I'm just like, I don't know. I think that there's both credibility in that argument that like, things could be different. That's like the whole hope of like communism or, like psychoanalysis, Marxism, like just in general, like that's the whole point, right? That things could be different. But not taking seriously the way that things are is hugely problematic, right? Like if we just say like, well, they could be anything, and then try to move from that point of perspective, well, then we're just like losing the ground upon which we can even stand in the first place, right?
Yeah, but what is standing?
Was that a serious question? I could go either way.
No, it was not.
Okay.
Please don't answer that question.
Okay. I was expecting y'all to make a Hegel reference after your episodes with
Conrad Sam. I was going to say, like, being upside down with one's feet on one's head.
Well, I mean, would it be useful to maybe give a quick overview of the big moments in, I don't know, let's say the 20th century of trying to combine Marxism and psychoanalysis, and giving an overview of like what has this looked like whenever this has been attempted, right? Because let's say for a moment, for sure, it's an open question whether they can be combined. So maybe what we could do is lay out, well, what has happened whenever they have been attempted to be combined, right? So I think, I can't even remember which article it is. It might be the Parker article, but I think the three big ones that we could single out, I would actually say four, although I don't think it, I think we have to have a pretty serious discussion about feminist readings of psychoanalysis in Lacan as it relates to Marx, I think, if we're going to do this topic justice. So I think that in that article, it kind of mentions that there are these three big attempts. So one, the first would be Althusser and Althusser's theory of interpolation, as it's actually drawing on Lacan's conceptualization of the imaginary and the way that, you know, we're addressed by a structure, by an ideological state apparatus or the hegemonic order. Basically tries to say, you are this, like it hails the subject, right? So I think that the critique of this is that in that one article, I, again, you know, whichever one it was, I think there are some pretty interesting critiques here to say that, well, the attempt to fuse psychoanalysis into Marxism, into a very scientific approach to Marxism and Althusser, fundamentally, like, was a pretty shitty understanding of psychoanalysis and a pretty bad read of Lacan. And so, you know, a lot of people still reference Althusser and that, you know, that concept as being fundamental to how we understand subjectivity in a Marxist kind of framework. I think it is worth critiquing to be like, well, but how right did Althusser get that? So that would be one. Second one would be Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe and their theories about hegemony and floating signifiers, which is kind of more oriented towards the symbolic, and that there are these signifiers that we fill with content like freedom, communism, democracy, you know, whatever it is. And so there's like active political struggles over who gets to define that content. And then the last would be Zizek's school, which is going to be focused on the real and the sort of death drive and the sort of traumatic cut at the heart of subjectivity. And so then I think, you know, we could also talk about, you know, what has the legacy been of Zizek's attempt, which I would say, you know, people like Todd McGowan, Mari Rudy, Alenka Zupancic, you know, a lot of the people that we talk about on Red Library are actually much more aligned with this attempt to fuse psychoanalysis and Marxism. So, I mean, to me, I think that's a helpful way to think about this, is to look at, okay, well, like, what have these attempts looked like? So I do think the fourth one that would actually be really important to talk about would be a very specific feminist interpretation, which would be, you know, people like Juliet Mitchell, Jacqueline Rose, Luz Irigaray, like people like that. So, and I do think there's a strong claim to be made that, you know, maybe if psychoanalysis has anything to say at all, it's about the way that we conceive of how the, like, who is the proletariat, you know, and like, and how is that made up, and how are certain groups, you know, certain identities aligned with that and sort of subjected to social structures and oppression and exploitation and marginalization in particular ways. So I actually think that might be, in my experience, I think kind of the more interesting readings in psychoanalysis and Marxism being fused together is actually in the feminist approach. That's why people like Mari Rudy are like pretty much paramount for me in terms of influence. You know, they're using all these different approaches, but also coming at it from this very particular feminist approach, which I think is, like, to me, has always been one of the most fruitful. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
No, I think that that's important. It helps contextualize this a little bit, because without that historical sketch, it does appear that for some reason, lately, out of nowhere, there is this new emergence of a thing that's like a Lacanian Marxism, which is just something that Zizek invented. And that's the way it's treated a lot, too. It's just like, well, yeah, you know, I've been a part of the left for a while, and I know you got your Mao and your Trotsky, and I kind of figure where the various divisions on the left are. And then there's this academic other thing, which is just people mashing shit up together to try to seem to make it, to try to make an imprint on the academy. And that's the way it's treated a lot. So, like, it is actually really useful to know that this is a century old engagement between every kind of Marxist and every kind of psychoanalyst throughout, let's, you know, the overwhelming majority of the history of what we're calling Marxism.
Yeah, and let alone
it helps lend credibility to the necessity of taking seriously that these two things have a relationship.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding of why this was initiated as a project in the first place, even prior to Althusser, like we mentioned the Frankfurt School, right? I think there are two primary problems that the Frankfurt School was really addressing. One, the rise of the culture industry and the way that culture was influencing the individual subjective experience of everyone. It was a way to try to make sense of, why did the revolution fail? Like, why did the proletariat not live up to its historical mission? And the question, I think, was, well, like, objectively, the material conditions, it seemed like things should have worked, right? So why didn't they? And I think the reference to trying to understand the way that culture and ideology and psychology and the unconscious were actually, you know, in some ways leading them to choose something that was absolutely, like, contradictory to their conscious interests, but not contradictory to their unconscious drives, you know, the drive in like fascism and death drive and all of this other stuff. So, you know, and I think that it's pretty, you know, you can make a strong case that, you know, what did that attempt lead to? I think it led to things like negative dialectics, things like, you know, Marcuse, and, you know, you can assign various levels of success to those, I think, in terms of what their project was. But, you know, to me, I think that's the thing, right? It's like, I think Zizek does deserve a huge amount of credit for his attempt to fuse Lacan and Marxism together in a way that I still think at the end of the day is primarily a political project. That's why I think people who read him as being like solely a psychoanalyst, I think, misunderstand Zizek's project. I think it is at the end of the day. I know he says like he's a Hegelian more than a Marxist sometimes, but I think Zizek still at the end of the day is concerned about politics. So right. I think to read him in that way as just being a psychoanalyst, I think is pretty simplistic and reductive of what his actual project is. But yeah, to me, I mean, it's just like, you know, this is something that's been attempted in all sorts of ways continuously for, yeah, at least a century. I think that, you know, to me, it's always helpful to have the historical context to make sense of, well, okay, why didn't it work before, you know, and is this the sign of an ultimately, you know, project that's fated to always fail, or is it about the changing historical tides and what works and what doesn't work at any time? I mean, again, to me, it's still an open question of whether these things could ever be fully combined. But again, I mean, my stance is I think they have really important shit to say to each other. And I think that they both suffer to the degree that they're not put in conversation, maybe like what you were saying, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, just to like tack onto that, I think I was going to say that, you know, I really think that it's like, for example, in this four fundamental context concepts article that we read, like toward the end, when there's the discussion of the parallels between like desire in Lacan and its reproduction of like, you know, your motivation as a human being in this like problematic way, and like talking about capitalism's current incarnation and how it's sort of like makes any form of resistance into a new way of like marketing to people, and then kind of like counterposing that with like the idea of drive in Lacan and how drive can create this sort of circular motion around the object of desire, as opposed to trying to like place it into the objet petit a, and like asking that question of like, how can we conceive of this in terms of capitalism? Like, what would it look like to develop a drive in capitalism, as opposed to like the problematic relationship that we have with the commodity of desire that just like endlessly forces us to like try to satisfy all of our needs through capitals providing us with just like endless trash for us to like consume. And so like, I think, you know, questions like that, I think, are like extremely interesting to think about. And with like a framework of analysis, and, you know, kind of this practice. And that's kind of where we run into that problem of like talking to psychoanalysts and kind of having a lot of them just be like, oh, no, you don't understand. Like, this is only for the clinic. This is only for like, you know, taking a particular subject in their particular symbolic universe and helping them through their own impasses of the unconscious. And then you're just like, shit, well, that, you know, like that doesn't help. Right. And that's why for me, Zizek is really like a really important figure. Once again, like Adam was saying, like, I think that we have to sort of tip our hat to the fact that like Zizek is making the attempt to like take this thinking, this like form of thinking in psychoanalysis, and like really try to find its limits in terms of like what it can really be applied to and how productive it could be in, you know, in this project of Marxism. Cause I mean, you know, I don't know if you guys are, you know, like watching Zizek lectures at all, or like, you know, but like I've seen a few, and I've literally, there's like that famous one that I remember where Zizek like yells at somebody and he's just like, I'm a card carrying Marxist, you know? And like, I find it interesting that people find it so easy to dismiss Zizek as a Marxist, right? Because I think that the way that Zizek talks about Marxism is something that most people just do not accept as like being within the domain of what Marx intended or how Marx is generally interpreted. And so what you end up with is just like people just putting a hard reject on it and just not even thinking about it. But how could Marx's ideas be enacted if not through something that Marx himself would have never really known or recognized himself? Like, I don't know, I guess like, how could he be in the position of like the people who would make socialism and communism a reality back when he was talking about it, right? Other than to say like, this is the beginning of something, you know, I don't know. So I don't know. I think I wonder about that. Like, what are Marxists really after if they're not willing to incorporate different perspectives on like the project that they're building?
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I think two thoughts on Zizek as Marxist. The first one is that he even himself says that like Lacanian psychoanalysis is not a substitute for Marxist analysis of society. Like he very consciously and explicitly tries to have both, right? Not to have the one supplant the other. But I also think that like, I don't think that Zizek's politics are particularly good, but I think that's different than whether or not he is a Marxist. Because, I've lately been tilting very heavily against this notion of Marxism as essentially an aggregation or checklist of political positions. Like Marxism is an analytical framework. And then beyond that, it helps, you know, that's something that people then use well or otherwise to make, you know, positions and strategies and tactical things. And like the article, Lacanian Psychoanalysis and Revolutionary Marxism, I think makes a pretty good, very quick argument that Zizek doesn't really think beyond the horizon of capitalism. You know, he sort of fits very well within the mental constraints of capitalist realism, and his like book about the pandemic that we did like an episode about, you know, earlier in the year, I think actually does a really good job of proving that. But I don't think that that makes him not a Marxist. I think that makes him presently incapable of strategically or politically envisioning a way out of the current conditions. That doesn't mean that, you know,
fucking same though.
Yeah, exactly. Neither right, like, can I.
Whoops among us.
Well, and right. And that's the great lie is that that's what makes you a Marxist or not. Because if that's the case, then the only people who are Marxists are weirdos who think that the way to the revolution is to put on a ski mask and go to the local socialist group and tell them they're not Marxists.
Yeah.
Because envision a way out. It's just insane and no one will ever follow them.
I was going to say, I think that whenever we critiqued Zizek, whenever he went up against Peterson, Jordan Peterson, we said that like his approach to Marxism wasn't really Marxist, like in his defense of Marxism wasn't really Marxist. And it kind of proves that he's more of a liberal than he is a Marxist. And I kind of feel bad about taking that line now, just because I wasn't as familiar with Zizek then as I am now, because there are many, many, many Zizeks. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the fucking Political Compass meme, right? With the different Zizeks in it.
Oh, actually, yeah,
that's
no,
a classic. That's a classic. God, yeah.
It's really good. It's in the authoritarian right part. There's him telling the anecdote about using the N-word. And
damn it. Yeah.
The authoritarian left part. It's like, and now we can say praise Stalin.
I love how it is not the Red Library gang that is initiating explaining a meme. It is actually one of y'all.
Oh, no. This is something that I've taken on as like a point of pride for myself to oppose Kevin's tyranny.
Oh, yeah.
Kevin.
Yeah,
Kevin's would be tyranny.
Memers rise up.
I'm nipping that tyranny in the bud.
I recall when we did that discussion about the Peterson Zizek debate. Somebody referred to it. Somebody we don't know, a listener, referred to it as a cold dish rag of a take.
And, ooh, ouch!
yeah, it was easily our harshest public criticism yet.
Wowza.
It was somebody that had like a shitload of followers on Twitter also, and they retweeted us and said it was a cold dish rag of a take. And I was just like, yeah.
Don't upset the internet, guys. Yeah.
But I went and looked at what he had to say about it, and he said it was like a brilliant defense of Marxism, which I don't think it was.
No, it fucking wasn't.
It wasn't. It was a very like mealy-mouthed, half-assed defense of Marxism. But that doesn't mean that Zizek's not a Marxist. It just means that he didn't make a very good defense of Marxism.
Right. I mean, that's the only thing I would change is I'm prepared to accept Zizek as a Marxist, just as much as I'm prepared to accept Althusser as a Marxist. But I don't think that he's right about very many things. But it doesn't mean he's like not a part of the lineage.
I actually think this might be sorry to cut in, Jason, but I do think this might be something that's pretty relevant to the Ian Parker article, which is him talking
that was
about
that was the idea. I was going to try to create a precisely that. That segue. So
pro,
go ahead.
Pro podcaster move. Well, I think that what Parker's getting at, though, is maybe it is a pretty clear bridge between the ways that people engage with Marxism and psychoanalysis, which is he kind of basically says there are usually two assumptions, which is that like some sort of practice or work is primary to change the world. Obviously, you know, revolutionary politics and Marxism, and then like clinical practice or going through analysis for psychoanalysis. But the other thing is the location of the work is also the accumulation of a tradition. And so I think whenever you are so thoroughly identified with either of these things as not, you know, an analytical framework, but as an, like an identity in themselves, which I just have to tell you, one of the things that I found to be most hilarious and tragically ironic in my time engaging with either psychoanalysis or Marxism, whenever they like rail against like quote unquote identity politics, is how thoroughly identified they are with like these practices as like an essential quality that one has. And if one doesn't have it, then one has betrayed it or failed it in some way.
Yeah.
And I think to me, that's one of the things I'm most harsh about in my criticisms of either people, like people who identify with either of these things, is that, well, it's like you've just reified this tradition as something that now serves as a foundation for your identity and like your sort of imaginary identifications in the first place. And so I think that, you know, what you're describing is like kind of a way to get outside of that, right? Like it, the question is not whether like is someone a true Marxist or not. I mean, you know, maybe like we need to get out of this idea if we're going to understand how they can relate to each other in a fruitful way. You know, it isn't about who is in, you know, carrying the torch in the most authentic way. You know, it's really about something
else. What is the real Marxist tradition?
Yeah. I mean, I don't fucking know. Do you know? Like, I've been studying this shit for a long time, too. I don't know what it is. Like, and I'm...
Well, I've got a little book I can show you.
Oh, is it a little red book? Because I have one of those. I like that book. It's a good book.
No, no. I'm talking about this book that we read. It's an IST book called What is the Real Marxist Tradition? And it shows the three false Marxist traditions, which are Kautskyism, Kautskyism, Stalinism, and then what was the other one that's fake? I don't know. There was three of them.
Oh, I mean, he's like he basically just equates everything else as like third world nationalism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is like extremely... I'm not going to use the language of the day and call it problematic, right? But it is, it's like a, it's like an extremely arrogant and dismissive way of taking the politics of like Fanon and Mao and Guevara and the Black Panthers and basically saying it's all third world nationalism or like, or Singh or, you know, basically all the Marxisms which aren't from Europeans. He's like, yeah, third world nationalism.
Oh. So can we just say yeah, it's racist? Can we just not say it's problematic and just say that's some racist ass bullshit? Yes,
fucking, some reductionist racism.
Yeah, a little bit. That's like, hey, yeah, let's measure your skull to see how good of a Marxist you are. Like, what's the ratio between your nose and your forehead? That's like, yeah, that's one step away from just practicing like, phrenology as your basis for Marxism.
The depth of your temple holes.
I gotta
that's
say
one
that.
Of those one of those disciplines and discourses that I don't think can find a fruitful engagement at the intersection with Marxism is phrenology.
Actually, I was just about to say that I think that you two guys have remarkably small noses for Marxists. I mean, all the best Marxists.
You, sir. Noses. Are you calling me an opportunist?
Adam, I think you're right to say that like it's this very question of what is the real Marxist tradition, which like makes it difficult to you know, honestly and in good faith and in an intellectually useful way, contend with and grapple with the questions raised by psychoanalysis as like a, as a discipline, which is outside, but also not hostile to and is in fact, perhaps complementary to the aims of Marxism. But if you first have to pick a tradition and stick with it, if that tradition doesn't already include psychoanalysis, then it precludes the intersection that we, I've been trying to basically revisit, like you said, over 100 years, or maybe I said that, but like I interpreted from what you were saying as that.
I mean, it is 100 years though, right? If you include Frankfurt School, it's easily 100 years. I will tell you, I mean, I think a good example of this actually being a complete disastrous failure of whenever you align yourself with the tradition and then try to see, well, will psychoanalysis fit with the tradition versus a much more dynamic, I think, like dialectical way to do it. I mean, I think about like the Platypus Society. You know, if you ever read through their syllabus, what do they read? They read Reich. That's it. And why do they stop with Reich? And like, why are they like very hostile to like Lacan and other like analysts? Because essentially it doesn't fit in with what they've defined the tradition to be, which is, yeah, you read up to Adorno and then you stop. You know, maybe you read
right, and that's not even their biggest problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's actually one of their stronger points, perhaps, that they do yeah. read Adorno, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that I've realized and I probably beat this. This is a dead horse that I'm beating here, is that how constrictive it was being part of a sect and how stultifying it was to my education. Like, I don't know. I read so much now that I would never have given a chance previously.
And well, Chris, in going over the effects of your upbringing on your psyche, I think that fits perfectly within the discussion about psychoanalysis and Marxism.
Yeah, maybe so. Right.
Also, I was just going to mention, y'all probably wouldn't be friends with us if you still were in that sect / cult.
No, and our podcast would be even more unlistenable.
Our podcast would be fucking dog shit, dude. Oh my God. I go back whenever Facebook shows me posts from like 10 years ago. I'm like, oh my God.
Like, no.
I typed this shit out. Like, I spent like probably an hour typing out this like gigantic effort post that no one is ever going to read. And all using all the correct jargon and all of the right Trotskyist points here and there. And then
I follow some IG pages like that, where that's like all they do. They just like post a picture that's like inflammatory. And then it's just like walls and walls of text of them just fucking railing against something that you're just like, who are you talking to? Like, who's reading this? And then like, you know,
the big other is reading it.
Who's reading it is the fucking like opportunists, man. That's who.
Yeah. They're like, teach me your ways.
I don't know if y'all actually listened to them, but I posted those talks that I did in the Discord as a public self-crit.
They weren't that bad.
Yeah, I started listening to the one on Lenin. I was actually, I mean, maybe it's just because we do a podcast network together, but I was like, I was intrigued.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
It wasn't as bad as your social democracy one.
No, that one was real bad.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I wouldn't defend those today, though.
I mean, maybe on some level, though, kind of what we found ourselves sort of talking about, I do think is actually maybe a fruitful area where psychoanalysis and Marxist revolutionary politics do have something really important to say to each other, which is, what is the way that we're engaging with revolutionary politics in the first place, and how much our own psychical structures or unconscious tendencies and drives like are pretty thoroughly wrapped up in how we're engaging with it. Now, I mean, maybe this is my own particular stance on this approach or the relevance of psychoanalysis to all this, but I think that the idea would be to be able to disentangle the way that like desire is operating and the way that you look at revolutionary politics or a group or a sect as fulfilling some sort of unconscious desire or drive that you have. You know, but I would say that the point to engage with it in a way is not to like turn your politics into psychoanalysis, but is a way to make sense of your own engagement with it as an object to then hopefully disentangle your own bullshit that you're trying to look to revolutionary politics to solve in a way that hopefully would allow you to engage in it in a much more effective and useful way without what I've heard call in a book by a clinical Lacanian analyst, like in a symptomatic way, which brings a lot of what, you know, would be phrased as like senseless suffering. It doesn't mean you like stop engaging in revolutionary politics. It does mean that you have to be able to disentangle like this senseless suffering as a symptomatic way of engaging with it. I mean, in my own life, I think that's actually been one of the things that Alex and I have gone through a lot of shit together in this way of engaging in these groups, you know, Maoist, anarchist, you know, Marxist, Leninist, whatever, and more liberal groups as well, and still coming away of being like, oh my God, like the just rampant nature of like symptomatic shit that is undermining everything that everyone's trying to do all the time seems to be a place where I found the most relevance for psychoanalysis, you know. And but again, I don't think that that means that your politics then becomes psychoanalysis, right? I think that's like a domain error where you're like overgeneralizing what you might find useful in a way that then sort of diffuses revolutionary politics, which I still think has to be the name of the game. I mean, to me, psychoanalysis, the way I frame it, is the way that Bruce Fink, a really legendary Lacanian translator, analyst, you know, writer, would phrase, which I think is to get us from being these like subjects of desire, which look to like something like revolution or whatever with a capital R, to fulfill this need that we have to like fill this gap in us as subjects that we just, you know, feel terrorized by and feel incomplete by. I think we have to get from that to being what he calls subjects of the drive, which is where you actually learn how to channel this like push that you have to like fill this gap and actually to learn how to experience what, you know, could be called jouissance in a way that allows you to like thoroughly engage with that and not try to paper it over or resolve a contradiction but to sort of like mobilize that contradiction in a new way that reduces this sort of symptomatic suffering, but allows you to engage in the thing even more fully. And I think for me, that's the place I found these two things to be most useful. I mean, outside of like social and cultural analysis and like someone like Zizek or like Mari Rudy, which helps me understand my own personal life in a completely radical way. But I think to me, that's actually been the thing that's helped me the most in terms of politics, is just learning how to stop engaging in this shit in a way that's symptomatically trying to fill a void, you know, because it's never going to do that. And then whenever it fails, of course, we all become horribly depressed and get out of it or become jaded or hyper cynical. It's like, because we wanted it to do something that we weren't even consciously aware we wanted it to do. So, for me, it's a very personal topic. You know, this isn't just a bunch of abstract shit. It's like very personally about how I engage in political practice and, you know, how I make sense of what it means to talk about Marxism or communism and you know, the overthrow of capitalism. It's like simultaneously the most complex abstract topic, but it is the most personal thing in the world to talk about.
So just in our conversations that we've had primarily with on the network roundtable that we do, what the fuck is it called?
Well, here we are still.
Here we are again.
Here we are still after all.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. It's been quite a long time since we did one of those things.
It's like 5 months. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a really long time. It's a bummer. I would like to do more. Hopefully we get to do some soon, but, it's just the level of jouissance that is like participated in, like when you're part of this like hyper activist sect, that you get so much enjoyment out of outrage and performing that outrage publicly. And another concept that I think that applies is death drive and the need to just destroy things around you, including like the lives of people that you disagree with that might be your comrades, you know, and the way that people will just focus in on like minutia about other people and use it to just like blow up a situation. Why? Like, why would someone do that? Why wouldn't someone take the collective into consideration? Why wouldn't someone want to build the project? Why wouldn't someone want to smooth over things? Why wouldn't someone want to try to like convince someone by patiently explaining? And why would everyone rather just destroy everyone or everything around them at all times? Yeah, I think this stuff is useful.
I have to close my window because I can hear the helicopter and it's very loud. And I just assume it's being picked up on the fucking
the helicopter.
Well, because I live next to a hospital. So like regularly there's a helicopter and I assume they have one.
I was going to say, who did we piss off, man? And they sent you the helicopter? Like, yeah,
you know, the helicopter that follows me everywhere I go.
You're like,
hang on one
like,
second.
Like in Blow, like where he's like watching the helicopter in the car.
Oh yeah, that's good. I was thinking Blow or either Goodfellas whenever Ray Liotta is driving. I was actually, the first thing I thought about was Demolition Man whenever he jumps out of the helicopter to go after Phoenix in the warehouse. Because I mean, you know, he's in LA, right?
Well, the thing that I was going to say, because we were talking about analysis and how, you know, you can become like, you were talking about Bruce Fink's idea of like becoming the subject of the drive, right? And it reminded me of that scene in The Departed. Where I think it's Leonardo DiCaprio's character goes in to see the therapist, and the therapist is basically like tells him, like, cause he gets all mad that she's giving him like some pills or something. And then she's like, look, man, like my only job here is to just like get you through, like get you over all your bullshit and just make you do your job, you know? And then like, I just remember that scene like so clearly and just being like, wait, is that? Like, is that what therapy is supposed to do? Like, I was like, no, I don't know if that's true. But I think that in reality, like, that's what it is. Like, that's what you come up against when you talk to a lot of analysts that are like, you know, just like clinicians. And they just, you know, that's the kind of how they conceive of their role as analysts. And I'm not saying all right, but I'm saying that this is like actually a common thread when you talk to psychoanalysts, that like their conception of what they're supposed to be doing is to like get people to stop having pretensions to some higher responsibility and like get past their own like internal conflicts or whatever and just make them like live their life in a more happy or stable way. And I'm like, no, you know, like much like what Adam was saying, I think that if somebody comes in, you know, and is like, oh man, you know, I just feel like so responsible that I need to do something in the world. And I think everything's fucked up. And I have these like ideations towards like, you know, revolutionary tendencies, right? Like, yeah, sure. There's absolutely like a pathological way in which that could be exhibited through the symptoms of this analysand. But like, I don't think that just telling them that they're caught up in the image and that they need to like give up their pretensions to something more important than their own lives is the way of doing, you know, of like treating that subject. I think that there's absolutely a way that you can preserve those revolutionary intentions without having them pursue it. Like, yeah, like Adam was saying in a, I hate to use the word again, problematic way, right? Like in a way that's going to, now we're fucked. Now we're just going to say problematic the entire podcast. But yeah, I just, you know, I think that there's absolutely a way that drive can be, or that desire can be morphed into something that appears more like a drive, and it can still preserve that revolutionary intent or that like idea of like wanting to engage with the, like the human responsibility to like, you know, change the world for the better.
Is this the answer to the question? Does such a thing as a leftist drive exist?
I think so. I think absolutely it does.
At least a part of it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think to whatever degree I think you could actually talk about it, to me, one of the most revolutionary things that psychoanalysis can give you a sense of, especially Lacanian analysis of all things, is a way to conceptualize your subjectivity, your most basic fundamental coordinates of the world, as actually being something that is collective and not individual. You know, the whole point of starting from Lacanian analysis, I think you can read this in different ways. I think there's absolutely conservative ways to read this, just to be clear. There are many, many ways to interpret Lacan, just as there are many ways to interpret any other, you know, figure that wrote so influentially, but also wrote so cryptically. But to me, I think that, yeah, you can interpret that conservatively, but I actually think that the best Lacanian theorists and writers who want to talk about politics, the main thing they come down is, what does it mean to be a collective subject first and foremost? You know, and how does one start from that, go through this period? It's like very dialectical. Like you go through this period of where you get collapsed into being an individual or like interpolated or however you want to think about it. But what analysis is really about is, in a way, I think, and this is the feminist framework that I think is most effective in this, especially people like Mari Rudy, is to say, well, how is this experience that you have of like what Alex is saying, your desire, is actually a way of like trapping these sorts of, or like creating these certain like ruts that become very repetitive, compulsive, that actually could be reshaped in different ways or could be directed in different ways that actually help you return to some integration of the fact that you are primarily a collective subject first and foremost. And to me, that's what's really fucking radical about it. Because outside of using analysis for that, I think, you know, this is why people still critique someone like Marx, right, is still operating on sort of the bourgeois individualistic ideas of the Enlightenment in certain ways. And I think that, you know, whether you want to buy that or not is a different question. But I do think that one of the things I think that Marxism needs drastically, especially at this point in capitalist development and the way that ideology functions and media and culture function and the way that we're socialized and subjectivized, I think we need a way to think of ourselves as collective subjects or some sort of form of that, which could make sense now. And I think psychoanalysis still has some of the best tools for that.
Yeah, I find that compelling. I think one of the questions which we are simultaneously trying to grapple with for another discussion we're going to have soon is precisely on this question of Marx as a inheritor of and carrier of the Enlightenment tradition or something else. And I think both yes and no, right? But this notion of a collective subject, I think it's in Marx, but it's not fully developed. And I think I share your basic proposition that it's something that needs to be much more fully grappled with and more fully incorporated into our understanding of what it is that we're trying to do. Like, you know, when you talk about like the proletariat as a class, not only in itself, but for itself, I think that we're starting to get at that same question of a collective subject. But I think it's probably no mistake that we don't actually have the language. Now we have the language for it, probably because of psychoanalysis and the engagement between the two. So I'm prepared to say, more or less, the comrades are correct.
Yes. I'm the great pretender. Pretending. I'm doing well. My feet is such. I pretend too much. I am lonely. But no. One person. Yes. I am the great pretender. In a world of my own. I play the game. But to my real shame, you left me to dream all alone. To hear is this feeling of make believe. To hear when I feel what my heart can feel. Oh, yes, I am the great pretender. Just laughing and gay like a clown. I seem to be what I am not. You see, I am wearing my crown like a crown. Pretending that you are still around. And so on and so on.
This is such a brutal irony. It's not a joke what I will tell you now. People think, oh, I'm extrovert, half crazy, but I have my problems. Never in my life, and never is not a metaphor for just once a year, never did I dance or sing. Never.